Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What would Confucius say about the revival of Confucian thinking in our frazzled Gilded Ages, both East and West? Confucius might well say, I told you so, that fragmented societies hooked on data, money, and me, would yearn for his elegant aphorisms in honor of harmony, family, social order, and human flourishing as the measure of success. Make us yearn is one thing, change our ways is another. Our guest, Michael Pewitt, in a dense little manual titled The Path, says the distemper of our times is begging for correction, if not cure, by the wisdom teachers of ancient China. Students in what is year after year Harvard's most popular course say Confucius is onto something for them.
What Confucius says is that we have to look for goodness in the ordinary, the mundane, routine tasks of our lives. If meaning can't be found there, then 90% of our lives are meaningless.
The key thing I've taken from Confucius is this idea of being aware and appreciative of the rituals you do every single day.
Rituals frame everything we do. When you teach a child to give up his seat on the subway for the elderly, he may not understand and he may not like it very much. But practicing this ritual behavior again and again, he might gradually develop a certain amount of veneration for elderly members in society.
I found Confucius's Analects to contain ideas that really do continue to influence me personally. First of all, the negative golden rule that permeates it, do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you, really just seemed to be so much more considerate.
Part of what Confucius was saying was that to be able to be fair to others and to be able to live a good and moral life, a person has to find comfort with his or herself. In order for society to be strong and to be good, each individual needs to be able to be strong and to be good.
How do I, knowing that I will die, live a good life? Not in an abstract sense, but as, hey, I'm alive. I have to give this my best shot.
This is the Confucius Hour. Michael Pewitt, welcome. We've been looking forward to this, but now you've got to change our lives. Where's to begin?
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. This is such an honor to be here.
We love your book.
Well, thank you so much.
Might not Confucius begin with the selfie epidemic, and it's as visible everywhere in China, Shanghai, Beijing, as it is in the United States. This, look, Ma, it's me.
Absolutely. And you're right. It's a global phenomenon. And it comes out of an entire vision of the self that has become pervasive. This notion that to live great lives, we should look within, find our true selves, find out who we really are, and then spend our lives loving ourselves, embracing ourselves for who we are, living sincerely and authentically according to our true self. Mm. And all of this sounds great, but the danger is precisely what you mentioned, that in practice, what this leads to is an incredible narcissism, an incredible focus on the self, on me, as opposed to others. And Confucius would raise a further issue, too. What if, Confucius would ask, we don't have a single true self that we're born with, that we're trying to find? What if we're messy selves? Very messy selves.
Multiple selves.
Multiple selves. And what actually we become depends on how we interact, how we grow, how we develop as human beings in our relationships. And if that's the case, if we're not working on those relationships, on those interactions, trying to grow as a human being, our danger is we fall into kind of patterns and ruts of interacting with others, usually very negative patterns and negative ruts. And then when we tell ourselves, well, I should love myself for who I am. I should just be true to myself. I just am the sort of person who, you know, has a bad
temper. To thine
own
self be true.
Exactly.
It runs so deep in our culture, including Jesus saying the kingdom of God is within you.
Precisely.
Know thyself, the Greeks say. Freud, essentially the same.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So how do we know all that good Western advice is wrong?
Well, the question would be a very simple one. What if when we do this, we're learning to love ourselves, find ourselves, embrace ourselves for who we are? What if what we're really embracing are just these patterns and ruts that we've fallen into? And Confucius would say the last thing we want to do is accept and grow to love those sets of patterns. He would say the goal is to grow as a human being. The goal is to overcome the self, by which he means overcome these ruts and patterns which constrain us and hold us back, and grow, teach ourselves through daily rituals, through working with others, how to actually become a good human being, which is not something we are naturally born as being.
Start with that phrase, learning to be human, and how we all hunger for it. Whose coinage was that to begin with?
Oh, it actually comes very deep in the Chinese tradition. And the idea is we are not naturally human. In other words, we grow to become a human being. If you take what you are from birth, what you'll actually have is, again, this messy self that will very quickly fall into ruts of interacting with others. And those ruts are often based on very selfish desires. And the danger is if we don't grow and cultivate ourselves, that's where we'll remain, which in a sense is kind of subhuman. To become a human being, you need to grow and learn how to actually interact well with those around you.
You know, I'm getting closer to getting this thing, whatever it is, than ever before. Read the Analects the first time probably 50 years ago. But how did it happen for you? When did you say, aha, wait a sec, this isn't just part of my history course. This could be life. This could be us. I could have hundreds of smart students, you know, reaching for it like a lifeline.
It came from the students. The intriguing thing is I've been teaching these ideas for a long time, and often, as you said, in history classes. And I found in a history class, when you start reading these texts, the students immediately start raising their hand saying, okay, I see how Confucius is responding to his time, and I understand what he's trying to do, but what would it mean for us? And it became clear that these texts were really speaking to them. And so I began to shift things around, and I finally just started teaching a class actually on how we can learn from these texts to be better human beings. And the students find them incredibly, incredibly powerful.
Where, for example, what are the lines, what are the clues? And I also want to know, when did you sort of put on the robe of the Chinese sage, which people see around you?
Oh, I'm sure I'm
the advocate, the apostle.
Actually,
it's beautiful.
It's been over the past few years. And it's, I think, in particular, this current generation. It's a generation that grew up being told, you know, again, look within, find your true self. And they've been hearing this mantra for so long. And now they're around age 20. And they're finding the mantra, on the contrary, far from allowing them to become liberated, free individuals, is working in the precise opposite way. It's creating a very narcissistic world. Mm. And it's a generation that wants something else. And for me personally, it was really in response to them that I began really beginning to say, let's start taking these texts seriously and see what they have to offer us.
How much of it is specifically this social web culture, including Facebook? There I am again. I have friends. It's me.
It's all
They're
me.
Noticing.
Yes, and absolutely. So much of our culture now is based on this idea that everything is about me and I can become a free, liberated individual if I just emphasize myself all the time. And the irony is, instead of becoming free and liberated, it creates a very narcissistic world in which, as Confucius would say, we become stuck in sort of the worst sides of ourselves instead of trying to change and grow.
I begin to feel a sort of takeaway in this notion of living for others. You cannot have a happy marriage if you're making your spouse miserable.
Yes.
However happy you think you are, you can't consider yourself a good person if the people around you aren't better for your being there. That kind of thing. Living in others, through others, giving to others. But I wonder, what are the other takeaways that your students remember? And why they feel that your course changes their lives?
Well, I think one of the big ideas they get, which is the very surprising one, is number one, this idea of overcoming the self. I mean, again, you're talking to a generation of students who've been told repeatedly, love yourself, accept yourself for who you are. And suddenly they're reading a text saying, no, do the opposite. Overcome the self. Break the self. Do rituals to try to slowly become a good human being. And at first, students find this very challenging, to put it mildly. But then they begin actually trying to do these little
rituals.
What
would be a ritual for getting over yourself?
Yes. So Confucius would argue, and I'm convinced he's right about this, we're doing little conventional acts all the time, usually by rote and never thinking about them. But if you make them into rituals, what you're doing for Confucius is, in those little conventional acts, the way you greet someone, the way you give up your seat for someone else in the bus, what you're really doing as well is you're developing the dispositions of what it means to care for those around you. And through those little daily acts, you really begin to develop those dispositions and you really start becoming a different human being.
We got to talk about my man, Ralph Waldo Emerson, because I like him so much and his self-reliance. But as I read the Analects of Confucius, Confucius is the anti-Emerson. It's old China and the sort of relational values in sharp contrast to that whole notion we prize in Emerson of individualism, the American religion. I mean, Confucius says in the Analects, study what brings contentment, which we like. But Emerson, in his own Circles essay, says, no, people wish to be settled or contented, but it's only so far as they're unsettled that there's any hope for them. I mean, can those minds be read together?
Intriguingly, yes. So what is so intriguing in both sides is both of them think our danger as human beings is complacency. Both think that we have a danger of simply becoming complacent, following the conventions of the day, continuing, as Confucius would say, these endless patterns and ruts that dominate our lives, and becoming so complacent we don't try to break them. And both of these thinkers are interested in trying to break this. How do we break out of this complacency and grow as human beings? So ironically, they're actually, even though they sound opposite, they're very similar in this regard.
That helps. I mean, and yet still, Emerson is a nonconformist. Confucius is Mr. Harmony. But Emerson says, society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. So trust thyself and beware. There is opposition out there. We're talking about Confucius. Coming up, as close as we'll get to Confucius himself today, the scholar that other scholars defer to in China, Du Wei Ming. This is Open Source. Speaking of Confucius, who is our guest Michael Pewitt's idea of a wise man for moderns, we met one of the preeminent Confucians in China by phone this week. Professor Du Wei Ming was telling us about the path to mastery, and I said it sounded like the way the transcendent athletes or musicians emerge and then grow. I was thinking of basketball's three-point shooting star Steph Curry or Yo-Yo Ma on his cello, and Du Wei Ming said exactly, music is the model of growth in humaneness. It's about going from the pleasure of Bing Crosby singing White Christmas to the tingling out-of-body grace of Yo-Yo Ma playing the Bach cello suites.
The process begins with the ability to be good. To be good is desirable. But goodness without any kind of internal substance is not good enough. Therefore, the goodness will have to be transformed into being true. In other words, there must be some substance in that goodness which you radiate out. But if that internal substance radiates brilliantly, then you can say the person is not only good and true, but also beautiful. Mm. Beautiful, like shining with brilliance. And if that shining with brilliance evokes a sense of awe of the people around, then it is not simply beautiful, it becomes great. Now, that greatness can transform itself. The greatness is not simply to show a grandiose vision, but it also feels comfortable for the person. And then that greatness that transforms itself will be called sagely. And when that the sagely effect of transformation is beyond perception, is beyond even human rational comprehension, then we say this function is spiritual. So from the idea of a good person to a true person, to a beautiful person, to a great person, to a sagely person. And of course, the sagely transformation is mysterious, therefore we call it spiritual. And that process is, of course, a ceaseless process.
That brings me back to Yo-Yo Ma. I mean, Steve Jobs, yes, the Apple computer guy, yeah, said when he heard, right, Yo-Yo Ma playing Bach cello suites,
yes,
he,
yes,
believed in God. He did not believe that man alone could produce the effect of that sound.
Yes. And in the Confucian tradition, music features prominently as a form of spiritual transformation or spiritual cultivation.
From Bing Crosby singing White Christmas to Yo-Yo Ma playing Bach, that's a big leap, but you're speaking of it as an example of the stages of Confucian mastery.
That's right. The mastery is a ceaseless process. Confucius said at the age of 15, I set my heart upon learning. At 30, I stood up. At 40, I had no delusions. At 50, I knew the mandate of heaven. At 60, my ears became obedient. Therefore, I'm able to take in any kind of sound from the outside without prejudging it. And at age of 70, I could follow the dictates of my heart without transgressing the boundaries of right.
There's lots more of our conversation with Du Weiming on our website, radioopensource.org. Michael Pewitt, so many of the magic words there from Du Weiming: love of learning, stages of striving, and something like divinity at the end of the road.
Yes, it's so beautifully put. And your analogy is perfect. We often think, for example, of learning a musical instrument or learning a sport correctly in terms of training. So it takes extraordinary levels of training for years on end to reach a point where you can play a musical instrument spontaneously and beautifully. Same thing with a sport. Mm. And in a sense, what Confucius is saying is, think of your life the exact same way. It's the everyday work, training yourself day by day through these little rituals in which you're developing proper ways of interacting with those around you, proper senses of how to care for those around you. And think of your life this way. And the beautiful quotation that Du Weiming read so just stunningly is exactly about that. It is a human being over the years, literally decades, slowly training himself to spontaneously sense the world around him, learning how to act in ways that will help those around him. And it's a never-ending goal. You will spend your entire life doing this, but it is indeed a perfect analogy to what one does if, like Yo-Yo Ma, you spend decades learning to be able to play a piece of music so flawlessly that you can simply move those around you by the brilliance of your playing. And what if we thought of our everyday lives in the exact same way? It's an extraordinary vision.
Practice, practice, practice.
Yes, indeed.
Steph Curry is such a perfect illustration these days of a discipline and a mastery.
Yes.
And then suddenly, aha, it takes your breath away.
Exactly. And yet we never think of our daily lives this way. But why not?
Anna Sun joins us from Kenyon College. And this year, the Bear Gruen Fellow at Stanford. She's the widely cited sociologist of religion, especially the Confucian revival in China, where she grew up. Anna Sun, welcome. I want to hear about the revival, but I also want to hear about the almost death struggle between Confucian values and neoliberal capitalist practice in China everywhere today. What's the score, so to speak?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. So I like how Michael speaks of his understanding of Confucianism as in dialogue with his students. My own understanding is in dialogue with people I talk to during my fieldwork in China, people who pray to Confucius in Confucius temples, people who conduct rituals in other religious sites. So what I am seeing, I've made two discoveries as a sociologist of religion. The first is that the Confucian rituals of ancestral rites are the dominant rituals in China today. So in the past year, about 80% of the people we surveyed conducted ancestral rites to the spirits of the deceased family members. Hmm. And the second discovery is that the Confucian ethical language, I think, is the mother tongue for people in everyday life. So you were speaking of this tension between the neoliberal capitalist language and traditional culture in China. And if we look at China today, it is an age of transition and inevitably an age of anxiety and uncertainty. So there are competing moral languages in China today. I can think of at least four.
Please.
Discourses of value that define what a meaningful life is for ordinary people. So the first language is the neoliberal capitalist language of self-interest and profit-seeking. So an example would be greed is good, as in Wall Street. And the second language is the official state language of serving the common good of the people. So an example of that language is to serve the people brings me the greatest happiness. The truth is that people...
That's a sort of watered-down communist line.
Exactly, okay. It's very watered down, and no one believes in that anymore. People, in fact, speak of it in an ironic way very often. The third language, I think, is the what I call the religious language of the reason to be. So if you're a Buddhist, you will say, I seek the blessings and teachings of the Buddha. If you're a Confucian, you say, Jesus is my savior. And China is a religiously very diverse country. So you do have people with different religious languages. But for me, the most interesting language is the Confucian language of filial values or filial piety. A common phrase would be caring for my parents, to be filial, is a foundation of being a good person. And also valuing rituals such as ancestral rites is also the foundation of a good life. I think of this language as very much the mother tongue. If you think about religion or even ethical languages, people often speak more than one language. I myself is bilingual. There are people who are multilingual. When you learn a new language, you don't forget the old one, and you may use different languages in different contexts. But there is a kind of comfort and embodied experience of a mother tongue that is irreplaceable. And I think of Confucianism in that way in China today.
Michael Pugh, do you want to comment on Anna's point?
Oh, I think that's beautifully put. And yes, my experience in China is identical. That, as Anna said so beautifully, you have these multiple languages, and yet the language of Confucius and all of these terms, these rituals, is a huge one, pervasive, and I agree, very much growing and growing.
Anna, your voice is a ritual unto itself, and I want to learn it. But it takes over the exchange in a beautiful way. But let me ask, people have always argued whether Confucianism is a religion or not. It doesn't matter to me how it's classified. But Du Weiming's notion that at the end of the practice, at the end of the life, at the end of Yo-Yo's performance is a spiritual truth of an unearthly, not human variety. Whether, as Confucius said, his own life could be a prayer is, to me, deeply fascinating. Is it for you and for Chinese people, Anna, a transcendental, an other dimensional truth?
I would say yes. The Confucian ideal of being a virtuous person, you can think of it as a transcendental pursuit. You can never quite arrive, but you're always trying. And that is something you see in many different forms of spiritual life.
Michael, what's your thought on the ultimate transcendence, the God question in Confucius?
I very much agree. Exactly as Anna put it, part of the goal is through your everyday life, growing as a human being, trying to build great worlds around one, and really achieving, in precisely that sense, a divinization of the human by precisely developing these great relationships.
Anna, you're under-describing, to my taste, the change in China, the depopulation of the villages where we think of ancestor worship thriving, the modernization in every imaginable Western way of life day-to-day in Beijing or Shanghai, in the big cities. I mean, they are as digitized and as ambitious and as calculating in all the bad ways and good as we are.
Yes. It is a surprise even to me when I do research in China and when I conduct survey research with a team of colleagues to discover that ancestral rites, the rituals of venerating the spirits of deceased family members has made a huge comeback in the past 20 years. And it is not only in the country, it is in the cities as well. There isn't a great difference between people living in urban areas and in villages in terms of frequency of ancestral rites. There's some difference, but not great. Mm. And in our latest survey research, we discovered that people conduct at least four times of different sorts of ancestral rites in the past year. So that is a very high number, I think, in terms of religious rituals. But if I may, I want to bring back a point Michael expresses so beautifully in his book. I'm going to quote a little. He says, Confucius is not about abstract questions such as what is the meaning of life, what is morality. He's about how are you living your life on a daily basis?
Hmm.
And to live one's life on a daily basis involves, in a Confucian sense, I think, the social rituals of treating others with kindness, with benevolence, but also religious rituals, such as ancestral rites.
Michael, how do you score the sort of bulldozer era in China, this sort of permanent revolution, but now a capitalist revolution, and the pressures that that puts on all the Confucian values we're talking about?
I think Anna has put it beautifully here. The two are actually working in tandem. So as you've had this, as you said, explosion of neoliberalism in China, there's also been a countervailing strong reaction against it and a sense that are we losing our values? Is everything come up for sale? And it's precisely at this time, as Anna is saying, that a lot of these rituals are coming back. Discussions of Confucian texts are coming back. You know, there's a huge blogosphere in China of people just endlessly debating things constantly on the web. And suddenly in those debates, all of these texts are back. People are debating passages from the Analects, even as they're also doing these rituals. So the two are actually going hand in hand. And how this will play out, who knows? But what's so exciting is suddenly all of this is back again.
It is, as you describe it, something to think about as you're on the path to Wall Street. I mean, it's a kind of a treatment for our financial obsessions, isn't it?
It very much so. Very much. I mean, if exactly so much of what we're talking about really comes to this exclusive vision of the self empowering itself through money, wealth, power, etc., it's very telling that you're also seeing as that notion, sort of neoliberalism writ large, has become so pervasive in the world, precisely at the same time you're getting such incredible interest in these notions of rituals and daily life and growing as a human being through how one lives one's daily life.
Anna, let me ask on the widest plane, what would it mean to be a Confucian nation? I mean, the ideology of China, the self-branding has been communist for getting on for most of a century now. What is Confucian about China's role in the world, even its self-image in the world?
That is such a great and difficult question to answer. I think Confucianism, as any great religious tradition, can be used in many different ways. And one should probably always be wary of political use of a religious tradition. Mm. So one can speak of Confucianism as a cultural identity. In fact, I sometimes use the term cultural Confucian. So if you follow the ethical teachings of Confucianism, if you consciously live a Confucian way of life, you can be a cultural Confucian, and you don't necessarily have to be a Chinese person to do it. I think Michael's students are learning to be cultural Confucians.
So am I.
But to speak of a Confucian nation is a tricky proposition, because I think it speaks of a political identity. And it remains to be seen how that has been developed. I think there's a lot of tension between the state use of Confucianism politically and also intellectuals' definition of Confucianism. And in my own research, I am also seeing this deeply grounded ritual experience of Confucianism, which is not political in its core.
Can you imagine, Michael, a Confucian nation that defined itself in terms of the flourishing of the whole world? Is that too much to ask?
I don't think it's too much to ask, and I think it would be an incredibly powerful vision. I mean, as An has put it beautifully, as all of these ideas are coming back, all these rituals are growing again, you're also getting the government trying to jump in as well. And if, on the contrary, the sort of stuff coming from the ground up is developing on these notions of flourishing, that would be an extraordinary vision.
Coming up, Confucianism in plain clothes, or cultural Confucianism, as Anna said. Would you recognize a Confucian situation, for example, in an American TV Western? This is Open Source. It is our guest Michael Pewitt's argument that practical Confucian values from 25 centuries ago can teach us the good life, even now, maybe now more than ever. But do we know those values when we see them in action? Two Chinese Americans in conversation this week shared their own curious discoveries of unspoken folkways that were bred in the bone and that pop up in their own lives as distinctly Confucian. Kaiser Guo is a perfect split. For 20 years now in Beijing, he has been a conspicuous player in the pop music and media scene. But in fact, he grew up in the States learning Confucian cues from his very Chinese father.
I learned to recognize them observing my father, who himself was a very Confucian kind of a man. I think about the television shows that he liked, and I was talking with my brothers about how my father's taste in TV was sort of odd. He was an engineer and a pretty talented one, and he installed this lock on our television and limited us to 5 hours of, you know, sort of our own viewing choices a week. So PBS, anything educational, any news didn't count against that 5 hours. And there were a handful of shows that he liked that didn't count against the 5 hours either. And when I think about what they were, some of them are kind of on the nose, like Kung Fu with David Carradine. That, of course, was very overtly teaching Chinese values, so he let us watch without objection. Another show that was odd was Bonanza. Do you remember that?
With, sure.
You know, the Ponderosa, with Ben Cartwright. And so that, looking back at it, was an incredibly Confucian setup, right? You have this patriarchal father with his three sons, and it's very situational ethics. It's sort of our family against the state. You know, there were always these sort of state actors who would come in and meddle. And where loyalties were to be laid down, they were always going to be to Ben Cartwright. So, you know, Hoss and Little Joe were going to be loyal to their dad, to Ben, and not to the state, right? This is a very Confucian idea. It's quintessentially Confucian.
Get out of our way and let us through. I don't think I have to remind you, you're on our land.
We know where we are. You'll find plenty more of us on your land. There's men blocking every road and trail from the low country. You can tell that to your father.
Oh, why don't you tell him, Mr. Lane? I'd like to see you stand up to my father and tell him just that.
That was Kaiser Guo and Bonanza. Who knew it was Confucianism? The novelist Gish Jen is a hyphenated American of the sort we used to call assimilated, born of Chinese immigrants to Long Island, New York. She went to Harvard, the Stanford Business School, and then the Iowa Writers Bookshop. Typical American was the novel that launched her. All the while, she keeps learning how Chinese and Confucian she really is.
When my first son was born, I belonged to a mother's group. And I still remember we went around the circle. The kids were, 6 weeks old, very little. And we went around the circle, and everyone in the room said that they wanted their child to be independent. And I alone was just shocked by this idea. You know, I also noticed that everybody else had put their child on the floor. There was a receiving blanket, but they had put their child on the floor in front of them. And, you know, I could not put my child on the floor. You know, the whole idea that the goal of child rearing is to have a person be completely autonomous could not be more un-Confucian, right? I mean, it's Confucianism is very much about being in relationship to others on every level. And I will say also in being in proper relationship to others. You know, it's been reduced to this idea that if you're Confucian, you have all these obligations and all these duties. That's not really what he was saying. You know, he was sort of saying, you know, we become ourselves through others and others become themselves through us. Anyone who's been in a family knows that that's absolutely true. My mother was always talking about, well, you know, how do you think that makes other people feel? How do they feel that blah, 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 blah? I was not asked, how do you feel? I was asked, how do you think you made so-and-so feel? You know, like hundreds of times a day, right? I could remember even at Christmas time, I would go with my father, and if we were having some presents wrapped by the gift wrap girl, my father would say, you watch her. She knows how to do. Yeah, and I was supposed to study, you know? It was a little lesson time for me to see the proper way to wrap a present. And to this day, the corners of my presents are perfect. My children just wrap the present any which way. So I have not, you know, I have failed to pass on this particular tradition. I guess in my heart of hearts, I guess I feel like, well, that doesn't matter. Many things do matter, but gift wrapping does not matter.
That's our friend Gish Jen, the novelist who lives in Cambridge. Anna Sun and Michael Pewitt, get us deeper into the matter of rituals, the ones we know and the ones we don't know, the ones we don't observe, but the ones we, in fact, want to build up ourselves. Anna?
Yes, well, I'm going to quote again something from Michael's book. He speaks of the malleable self, the self that is constantly changing. Mm-hmm. And we in the West, in the Western tradition, we think we change who we are through thought, through consciousness. But in the Confucian tradition, we understand transformation as transforming who we are through action. And experiencing good and doing good things will make us good. So in other words, self-cultivation is the process of doing small things in order to be to achieve goodness, to achieve a higher level of virtue. So rituals come in, both social and religious rituals come in. For example, religious rituals in China today, especially ancestral rituals, bring the families together. In general, people don't do ancestral rituals on their own. They do this with their family members. And this emphasis on ancestral rites would bring the family physically together several times a year in this age of great mobility, when people are focusing on achieving success in the marketplace. This gives them an incentive to go back to their home cities, hometowns. They do things with their families, which these actions enforce certain ethical values and behavior, and such rituals in the long run also maintain social order, especially in a time of great anxiety and uncertainty.
Michael Pewitt, recommend some rituals to us.
Absolutely. And just to underline Anna's point, I mean, we tend to look down at rituals because we think rituals tell us what to do and we like to just be ourselves and do what we want to do. As Anna said, from this tradition, on the contrary, rituals are training us to be good human beings. So let me just give a very concrete example. A rare moment when we actually do a good Confucian ritual, even though we don't realize we're doing it. Imagine training a child to say please and thank you at the dinner table. And what you're
May I be excused, please?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And what we're really doing there is we're asking the child to act as if he and I, a parent and a child, are completely equal, and he is learning how to ask something of another human being and how to express gratitude. And by doing that ritual, he's developing the emotions and dispositions of what it would mean to sense another human being, make requests of another human being. And then by doing it for years on end, eventually, of course, he reaches a point where he can sense how to express gratitude and how to ask for something when a mere please and thank you would be, you know, either woefully inadequate or way too formal. But it's only by doing that ritual does he actually slowly learn how to sense other people and how to sense how to relate properly to them.
Anna, the ritual that brought our family together growing up was the Jack Benny Show on CBS Radio, Sunday nights at 7. Be there, everybody. But I'm also thinking about milking a cow morning and night when I was a young teenager, or serving, you know, as an altar boy at Latin Mass. I mean, that's a real ritual, but also a real felt ritual. Recommend some more, Anna. I mean, I think we love ritual. I think we probably underprize it, but know that we miss it terribly.
Absolutely. Family dinners as a social ritual. Monthly lunches with friends. You know, when I see an old friend, I would say, let's get together. And we never get together. We don't make the effort to make it into a ritual, a routine in our lives that we treasure. There are rituals for me, for the most part, especially in the Confucian understanding, is doing things with other people. And knowing that you are not alone in the world. Your life is always connected to other people's lives. And here I want to say that I actually don't see a great difference between, say, people in China and my students at Kenyon College. My students do a lot of wonderful social rituals with their friends and with their families. They're very close to their parents, in fact. But what's lacking is this understanding of the importance of such rituals, of doing meaningful things with others. So we have this language of individualism. I think Jish Jian spoke of that beautifully. We all think of ourselves as individuals. But the truth is that even in the West, in the States, our lives are deeply interconnected with other people's lives. But our language doesn't do our own experience justice. And in turn, it prevents us from developing deeper interconnections, deeper ties with others. So by speaking of Confucian life or Confucian way of understanding rituals, understanding a good life, we're acquiring a new moral language. We're becoming bilingual ourselves. We're speaking of individualism, but also speaking of the importance of family, community, society in a Confucian way.
Anna, you're fantastic. Michael, I want to ask you, part of the skeptic in me associates this kind of ritual with A, childhood, B, a kind of rural way of life, and in the Chinese case, a kind of reinforcement of an authoritarian regime. Like, just shut up and do what we did yesterday. I'm the boss. What's open to challenge here?
Absolutely. I mean, rituals can go in all sorts of different directions. So in the please and thank you example, the as if there isn't of a hierarchical world, the as if is of a completely equal world, which of course isn't true. I mean, the fact is it's an adult telling the child, you must now say please and thank you. And if you don't, you potentially could be sent to your room. So it's in fact not an equal world, but the ritual can present it such. And that's the key. So a ritual basically creates an as-if world where for that brief moment you act as if you're a different human being, relating to others in a different way, and that's how you develop these dispositions. So in answer to your question, you can have egalitarian rituals, you can have hierarchical rituals, you can have rituals that work in a rural area, that work in an urban area. An example of the dinner table is a perfect one we do all the time. You know, families screaming at each other, playing out their usual patterns and ruts. But then if you do the ritual properly, you stop, you light the candles, set the table, and you sit down, and suddenly you become a different person, connecting with those around you in a different way. And over time, the argument is if you really do this properly, you're developing a proper sensibility of how to relate to those around you apart from the usual ruts that kind of dominate our relationships.
Anna and Michael, I wonder, how do we ritualize in a modern way in China and in the West a reverence for equality, for the fundamental common humanity of all of us in this competitive rat race with so many unequal blessings? What's the ritual of a kind of human unity?
That is such a great question. I would say, let us meet one another face to face. What's interesting about ritual is that it is, for the most part, analog, not digital. You cannot have dinner with someone online, even though people have tried by setting up cameras and having dinner together in that way. It doesn't quite work. You have to be in the same place. You have to
After half an hour, you're hungry again, right?
Exactly. And David Wong, a philosopher at Duke, speaks of rituals as a way of solving conflicts in communities. So let's say there are two communities with very different views about issues like gay marriage. Well, what if we can bring people together and have a joint dinner? And we can fight it out. We can express our disagreements. But by seeing one another face to face, there's something very precious about that experience. Mm. We are being fully human. And I think that's one of the problems with inequality. It is so abstract to us today. Mm. How many of us have spent time with someone who goes to bed hungry every night?
Mm.
And to have that experience will profoundly change our sense of justice.
Michael and Anna, I wish you'd both give us one, two, tops three of your favorite Analects to take home. Michael, would you start us?
Sure. One of my favorites is one of the ones students find so challenging, and yet I think gets to the heart of everything we've been discussing.
Hmm.
To become humane, overcome the self, and submit yourself to rituals. Which sounds, of course, to our ears horrible. Why would I want to submit myself to rituals? Why would I want to overcome myself? But, of course, the argument is, no, if the self has a danger of falling into these patterns and ruts based upon selfishness, what you're doing when you, for example, do that please and thank you ritual, you're forcing yourself to overcome what's become your natural way of being. And by forcing yourself to do that, you overcome that self and begin the process of becoming a humane person.
One more?
Sure, one more. And there are several actually that do this that will describe Confucius. And we tend to think of Confucius as this ritual fuddy-duddy who just follows rituals but must therefore be this very formalistic person. There are several quotes that will actually refer to Confucius as this joyous figure, someone who is so joyous in his daily living. And the key being, going back to Duane Ming's quote, by simply living his daily life and training himself through it, he's reached a point where spontaneously he's able to connect with those around him.
He does sound powerfully happy, I got to say.
Very powerfully happy.
Anna, an Analect to remember.
Yes, I will just give you one example. Confucius asks his students, his favorite students, to express their wish, what they wish to be. So one wishes to be a benevolent ruler. Another one wishes to be a very good officer in ritual ceremonies. And yet another one says, my dream is to, on a spring day, go to the river with a few good friends, singing and dancing and feeling the spring breeze on our faces. And Confucius sighs and says, my heart is with the last one.
And yours too, your heart too, Michael, I think.
Indeed, fully.
Anna Sun, thank you so much. Michael Pewitt, thank you for being here, and thank you for this wonderful book, The Path. What Chinese philosophers can teach us about the good life. Thanks also to Du Wei Ming in Beijing. Come see us in Boston, please. And Kaiser Guo and Gish Jen. Visit our website for longer conversations with each of our guests, radioopensource.org. And while you're there, sign up for Max Larkin's very Confucian newsletter every Sunday. It'll make your day after church. Our show this week was produced by the noble spirits Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Abby Duker, and Phil Guerra. George Hicks ritually engineers our program. Mary McGrath is our sagely producer. I am Christopher Lydon on The Path. Join us next time on Open Source.